2050. Der Future Podcast mit Markus Nettelbeck.
Welcome to another episode of 2050, the Future Podcast. Have you ever wondered what happened to your old IT equipment when you don't need it anymore? Today we will learn how IT can become more sustainable in the future. My guest today is Niklas Sundberg, CIO of a global company in Sweden and author of the book Sustainable IT, Playbook for Technology Leaders, which will come out soon. Welcome to the show, Niklas.
Thank you very much, Marcus. Very happy to be here.
Who are you and what are you doing?
Yes, like you said, I spend most of my time in Sweden in a global company, manufacturing company. And also besides that, I have a real big passion for sustainable IT and how we can use efficient energy more efficient, but then also to use our hardware more efficiently and make sure that we have a longer lifespan of our equipment that we use in our everyday life and in our work setting.
What made you excited about green IT and sustainability in this area?
I think the interesting part of being a CIO is that you're always tasked to reduce cost optimization. But then also looking at sustainability, there's not really an indirect relationship between them. It's actually a direct relationship between them. So if you can run IT more efficiently with less units of power, with less resources and so forth, then you will be a lot more sustainable. So it translates both into cost optimization, reduction of cost, but also in how you can reduce energy, how you can reduce your IT hardware, and so forth. So it's a very, very good and interesting mix to pair them together.
Ah, that's obvious. Just in preparation to this podcast, I stumbled over two words, and it's green IT and sustainability. What is the difference between these two words in your eyes?
Yes, I would say sustainability is a wider perspective with where you encompass both environmental, social, and governmental aspects. The ESG, like you talk about it. But if you just zoom in on green IT, that is mainly related to how you can improve the environment, so to say. So sustainability is a wider perspective than just green IT. But they are complementary of each other, I would say.
Yeah, and the whole topic is a wider topic, and we need to have a closer look to the sustainability sustainability part here. So when talking about green IT, so we immediately think about the hardware we use all day, of course, like laptops, mobiles, etc. But there are other significant factors in IT playing a significant role as well, which are maybe not as obvious as, let's say, old smartphones in our drawers, right?
Exactly. So I think the biggest challenge that we see is with the increased digitalization that's coming like a tsunami across the world, with increased need for more compute power for artificial intelligence, for machine learning, for autonomous vehicles and so forth, which also requires more capacity in data centers. So what we see today is that we have, in 2020, we have an electricity demand globally of 25,000 terawatt hours. And the expected global electricity demand in 2030, just 8 years away, it's somewhere around 40,000 terawatt hours. So we are increasing our energy demand quite rapidly. But then also when you look at the whole ICT sector, where just data centers today consumes 2 to 3% of the total energy worldwide. And in terms of emissions, that is on par with the aviation industry. And then if we look ahead to 2030, there are global expected electricity demands for the entire ICT sector, internet communications and telecom sector, that we were going to move from maybe 3 to 4% of total energy demand that we have today to 8,000 terawatt hours in 2030. So if the global expected electricity demand is going to be around 40,000 and the ICT sector is going to require 8,000, then it's roughly 20% of the future energy demand. And I think that's very, very concerning that IT needs to play a significant role, obviously, in the digitalization, but we also need to make sure that we deliver IT in a more sustainable way.
How could that work? So we see that digitalization is everywhere. So it's not depending on a branch. We see it everywhere. And as you said, so there's an increased demand of computing power. We saw that through the pandemic that everybody has subscribed Netflix, if not yet there, and everybody was streaming because of the fact that nobody could go out. And also, I think these Teams and the Zoom call things, they eat also a lot of computing power. How can we get out of this, let's say, catch-22 situation that we need to digitalize, but we also need to reduce our energy consumption somehow?
Well, I think fortunately, this is not really rocket science, but you need to make some smart decisions in how you choose to operate your data centers, or if you're using a third party party like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, for example. You need to make some choices in terms of where you put your workload. So one thing that's very, very important to remember is carbon-free energy. That's really the key to power data centers going forward. So we want to put the workload where we have very low carbon intensity, for example. And for example, in Europe, there are some regions like Switzerland, France, Finland, Sweden, Norway, which we have a high concentration of renewable energy. And also the carbon intensity is fairly low. So you can get down to a carbon intensity per kilowatt hour. So kilowatt is sort of electricity measurement for how you power your data centers. And then the carbon intensity is how much carbon you emit into the atmosphere for each kilowatt hour. So in Sweden and Norway and Switzerland, for example, you can get down to a carbon intensity of 24. But likewise, if you put that data center capacity in Poland, for example, today, just looking at the electricitymaps.com, for example, then the same kilowatt hour, the cost to spend that in terms of carbon intensity is 520 grams of CO2. So it's a big difference in terms of where you choose to place your workload, for example. Similarly, in North America, if you place your workload in eastern parts of Canada, for example, in the close to Nova Scotia or Quebec region in Montreal, you can also achieve a lot lower carbon intensity as opposed to putting it in Virginia or West Virginia, for example.
So these are the renewables like water or something like that. And the countries you mentioned before, they are also known to be not too hot in the summertime. So maybe also a good place to have data centers there in regard of cooling. On the other hand, we had also a podcast where we have talked about where the new energies, the renewables should come from. And there was one idea to bring solar power from the deserts into, let's say, hydrogen into tanks or pipelines to us in a way. Wouldn't that work to have data centers, let's say, in the desert and then having all the sun power used for operating the servers and, of course, cooling them?
I think the challenge is that you have a lot of excess heat from the data centers that, in an ultimate setting, you also want to capture that excess heat and you want to push it back into the electricity grid. for example. So what you see today is that you have some providers that have already started that actually they can claim that they are net positive in terms of how they provide their data center services, because they have joined up together with the grid or the electricity providers, where they power the data center with renewable energy, like you said, with wind, solar, hydrogen, water, and so forth. And then once the excess heat is instead of just releasing it into the atmosphere, they actually trap it and then they push it back to the electricity provider. And they do the same thing with water, for example, to have a renewable system for water. And then the energy can then be pushed out into the grid. So they can heat homes, it can heat industrial sites and so forth. So it's also about combining more than one industry. So it's not only looking at isolation of the data center or technology together. We need to work together with the utility companies to create this ecosystem together, where we can be net positive in these type of settings.
Do you know if there's already a proof of concept where this is tested somehow?
Yes, there is a company in Falun in Sweden called Eco Data Center. They have already three data centers live with this, and they have been audited by external audits, and their sort of calculation is that they are 33 grams CO2 positive per kilowatt hour that they consume, because they push back 48 grams back to the grid, and then they also spend 14 grams. So the net turns out to be 33 out of that, 33, 34. So there are already data centers like that, fully operational, closely interlinked with the utility companies. And I think these are the solutions that we need to look a lot closer together, where we need to have cross-industry solutions put in place.
Yeah, this sounds very promising. Do you know if there are already plans to extend that?
Yes, absolutely. I think the challenge is also that you need to put the data centers in fairly close proximity to where you have in an industrial zone or a residential zone, because you want to use that excess heat and push it back onto the energy grid. So you first of all, you need to have a grid that is supports dual flow, not just one direction. It needs to be able to receive energy from back from the provider, but also you need to ensure that they are close enough, close proximity. So placing a data center just up north of Sweden, where there's very low density of people, and you have nowhere to push that energy, doesn't really make sense as well. So you need to put it in close proximities of fairly large cities, I would say, to make this equation work.
That's interesting. So dual flow infrastructure is needed. So that's in this regard very interesting. So looking at other options to provide the grid with energy which is available. So we had that with electronic cars, with batteries, with high power volume, and batteries who can feed the grid out of their power if it's not needed. So we had another podcast saying that cars are in the parking if they are not shared for 80-90% a day, and if the battery is filled enough, it's possible to feed some energy out of the batteries back into the grid. So it seems that this feature, having this dual flow capability, is needed elsewhere as well. So a good idea to think about how we build our infrastructure in the future, and to use different opportunities to get forth back and forth with energy. So,
yes, absolutely. And I think the same thing goes for data centers, that when you have the backup and if you lose power, for example, rather than having diesel generators as your backup, which is not really that sustainable, you need to have batteries, high power batteries that can also be your backup solution. And also, obviously, like you said, harvest energy. And when it's in excess, it can also be pushed back onto the grid and be sort of recharged when needed, so to say.
Right. So there are things already going to the right direction. So let's cross fingers that all the tests are very successful, that we see more data centers being able to run neutral or negative. That would be great. Looking at our homes and on our office desks, there are a lot of equipment and devices, and so also battery is there. One of the topics we see, most of the modern smartphones, they have built-in batteries. Most of the modern equipment does not have any option to replace anything anymore. Something breaks, you have more or less buy a new item. So what about all of these electronic waste?
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point you bring up there, Marcus, because globally, just looking at electronic waste, the world consumed or generated 57 million tons of electronic waste worldwide in 2021. So this is obviously the biggest waste stream that we have in the world currently. So we've sort of built a foundation where we are replacing technology, physical infrastructure very rapidly, and we're not taking enough attention to circularity, moving from a linear flow to a circular flow. And this is just going to increase because today there's almost 5 billion smartphones out there in circulation. And by 2025, we're going to have roughly 60 billion devices out there in circulation. And before you get an iPhone or a smartphone in your hand, 80% of the CO2 footprint has already been spent before you even get the device in your hand. It's already been spent in the manufacturing process, in the logistics. And then actually the use phase between 3 to 4 years, it's actually only between 12 to 14% of the total CO2, depending on if you can charge your smartphone with renewable energy, or if you charge your if you run your computer on carbon-free energy or what have you. So the biggest challenge is really that we need to rethink how we manage our IT hardware going forward. We need to make sure that we can prolong the longevity of the products that we use. A big challenge, like you just mentioned, with batteries in a smartphone is that they are very hard to replace. And if you do try to replace it by yourself, then you actually void the guarantee, the warranty with the vendor. And fortunately, you're seeing vendors like Fairphone, which is a company from the Netherlands, which actually provides the opportunity to replace the battery within 2 to 3 minutes by yourself. You can replace the camera, the screen, the back. Everything is built in terms of modularity. So I think we need to shift to a way where we should be able to replace components when they break, and to make sure that we can live longer with the assets that we have.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea why award-winning concepts like the Fairphone, which is upgradable and recyclable, do not get a larger success and acceptance in the market?
Well, I think it's coming. I think it's fortunately there are EU legislations saying that we need to have a right to repair. There is the EU taxonomy is coming out in full effect in 2024, where all companies with more than 500 employees need to disclose a non financial statement in terms of their CO2 footprint. There are also directives where right to repair directives, where manufacturers actually have to enable consumers to be able to replace spare parts and make them more modular going forward. But obviously, this cuts into the revenues of these providers as well. So they need to also look at other types of revenue streams and to move from a more linear business model to a more circular business model, so to say.
Are there other companies in the world providing such concept like Fairphone? So I, in preparation of the of this future cast, I came across Fairphone, but I was doing hard to find others.
No, I think Fairphone is probably one of the biggest ones out there in the market. I think EU has taken steps where they said that the USB-C by 2024 will be the de facto standards. So taking steps to be able to use just one accessory to charge your different types of devices. But like you said, I think Fairphone is actually one of the few major players on the market where they have full modularity in their offering or their product offering, unfortunately.
Right.
Nachgefragt.
Nachgefragt is our Q&A section. In this section, former guests and listeners can ask questions about some topics they are interested from our current guest. Tom Linkens was my guest in two future casts, number 6 and number 9, where we talked about cybersecurity and the future of the travel industry. He has two questions for you, Niklas.
Hey, Niklas, this is Tom. So here comes question number 1. I've come recently across some platforms like software as a service solutions where you could basically fill in your IT data and then it would come up with a kind of an ESG sustainability index where you could benchmark against your competition and also track the impact of your measures. So do you use anything like this or what are your thoughts around this?
Thank you. So what an excellent question. And I think, yes, I have come across a number of these. And I think the challenge with this, and we probably have to back up a bit and talk a little bit about the taxonomy in terms of carbon emission and what sort of is that and what can you affect in internally within your company, and then also what sits within your full supply chain, both from producing your products, manufacturing them, but then also in the use phase when you've sold them and you have moved them over to a consumer and they are consuming and using your product. So from a taxonomy perspective, scope 1 and scope 2 is what sits within the realm of your organization. And I would say that's fairly easy to measure today. So your direct emissions, your scope 1, your facilities, your equipment, your vehicles, your on-site landfills and so forth, that's fairly easy to measure. Same thing with scope 2, which is really your direct emissions, which is your energy that you purchase. You purchase electricity, your heating, and your cooling. The challenge is really your scope 3. And that goes for sustainable IT as well, because then you need to factor in your transportation, your distribution, your waste, your energy and fuel, your leased assets, your corporate travel, for example. But anything within sustainable IT, like infrastructure as a service, platforms as a service, your software as a service, platforms and so forth. And that makes it a lot harder to measure. So I think from a scope 1, scope 2, it's fairly easy to benchmark. And you also see that banks are taking very good steps today as well, I think, where they're giving companies an ESG rating based on their score. And they are not going to get as cheap financing unless they have a high ESG score, so to say.
So we can say that sustainability becomes a kind of quality dimension for products, services, and companies in the future, even more.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's not really from only one perspective. It's not only from the consumer perspective or from the employee perspective, but it's also from the investor community. The companies that invest in these large companies, they are asking about these tough questions, for example. If you take a manufacturing company, which, for example, we can take the car industry, which uses a lot of steel and aluminum, for example. And one big factor in terms of emission is steel today. And you see now that consumers, investors, employees, they are asking their companies to start using low carbon steel. And I think in a few years, this whole dynamics and this whole supply chain is going to be completely redrawn in terms of how you source your different materials.
Yeah, I see that in my hometown. So I'm in Germany, in a very traditional steel city, and even ThyssenKrupp, the main company here, is now making steel with hydrogen. So that was quite new to me as well. So, but this is the, let's say, the heavy metal industry, and the yes. industry using a lot of energy, and it's very obvious there. So, but for the future, and also for medium-sized companies, does it make sense to have an international certification scheme which can be easily understood by business and also end customers? So like a kind of like a test authority or something like that, giving kind of a stamp that with a rating or something like this. Is that thinkable?
Yes, absolutely. And I think I mentioned the NFRD before, which is it's the non-financial reporting directive, which is an EU directive. And it falls under the umbrella of corporate sustainability reporting. So by 2024, so we're only 18 months away, any company that's larger than 500 employees need to adhere to these standards, and they need to comply with these, and they need to disclose any matters regarding environmental factors, social factors, treatment of employees, respect for human rights, and corruption and bribery, and so forth. So I think these legislations are coming into effect quite rapidly. And by January 1st, 2024, you need to start reporting on these, which means that you actually need to have the data for 2023 already at hand. So this is coming quite quickly for any large company with over 500 employees.
Right. So, and if it's for 500 employees, then a couple of years later, we can expect it to have for smaller companies as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think this directive is inevitable.
Right. There's another question from Tom.
Now, question number two would be that obviously we can save with, especially in the data center area, quite some CO2 and reduce our CO2 footprint, be more sustainable with this. However, IT can have manifold impact on the footprint and the sustainability of the overall company. So can you explain how you deal with this kind of indirect effects? Because it could happen that you basically are, let's say, in terms of CO2 footprint, be less sustainable in IT, but you have digitized some processes that were quite physical before, that were not sustainable, that are now sustainable, so that the overall impact in the company is positive. Thanks for this. Bye.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, and I think that's very important to distinguish. And in my book, I refer to two different taxonomies. One is sustainable IT, which is really what directly impacts your CO2 emission from your IT internally. But then sustainable by IT is what you can do in terms of having an indirect CO2 emission decrease. And obviously with technology, with IT, there is great opportunity to leverage technology to unlock a number of action areas within transportation, within manufacturing, within how you manage your energy efficiency within buildings, how you manage the grid. I think the pandemic is a great example where we transitioned from a nearly office-centered work environment to a hybrid-centered work environment where people are working from home mostly. And that is reducing the need for commute, but it's also reducing the need for business travel and so forth. But then also, I think in addition to that, we also see the leverage of new e-services, for example, like using contracting for employee contract, customer contract, supplier contracts, customer quotes, and so forth. So I think it's important to distinguish between sustainable IT, which is really your direct CO2 emission reduction, and sustainable bio-IT, which is your indirect CO2 emission reduction.
Yeah, and I think a more holistic view is important here. So it reminds me a little bit in the calculation of the total cost of ownership for purchasing. So you don't need to see just the price. You have to see all the dependencies here. And thinking about digitalization processes, that we bring more and more processes into a digital form. And of course, that needs more computing power. But in the end, if we are gaining some more efficiency on the other side, which is reducing our CO2 footprint in the company overall, then it's worth to have this complete view on it. And this is far more than just IT, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it comes back to the CFE contract acronym that I mentioned before, which is really carbon-free energy. So in your sourcing contracts with your vendors, you should start asking these questions in terms of, can you place my services for collaboration, for emailing, production, productivity tools, contracting tools, what have you, to place that in a carbon-free energy zone. So I think that is really to start asking these tough questions to the vendors, and they will have to respond by providing services where the carbon intensity is quite low to provide these services. So there is a relationship between there as well.
Yeah, and thinking more into the future, this could go into the tenders and could become a KO criteria if a vendor is allowed to quote or not.
Yes, absolutely. And I think more and more you see these in these type of tenders with different types of vendors, not only for data center vendors, but also for IT hardware vendors like Lenovo, Dell, HP, and so forth. So it's very important not to just look at the price, but then also looking at the full life cycle of the product and how you can put sharper and more tougher sustainability requirements, because it's also good for business, because it will reduce your cost as well by having a prolonged longevity of your hardware, for example.
Mm-hmm. Let's have a look to the software side of the IT and sustainable IT. So computing power is also needed if I have, let's say, poor programmed software in a way. Does that have an effect as well?
Yes, absolutely. And I think there are great initiatives out there. You have the Green Software Foundation, which has come quite far in developing a standard for how you can measure your carbon intensity on your software. There are open source tools available which you can actually connect and start measuring your intensity on your software that you are developing, for example. And then you can also connect it to the electricitymap.com, for example, where you can also in real time discover what is your carbon intensity here and now, for example? And then you can actually replan your software. So maybe you want to run some of the batch programs in the early mornings where the carbon intensity is quite low, instead of during the day when the carbon intensity is quite high. You want to rethink your strategy for all your environments for testing, for example, that you shut them off during the night times or over the weekends, for example. But then also to constantly work with your architecture, to re-architect your solution where you can actually see that you can decrease the energy and improve the energy efficiency within your application and have that direct relationship. I think it's very important to empower developers and architects to have a better view on their application and what their carbon intensity is.
Is that skill set, is that already trained in if you study these programming skills somehow, or is that quite new that you have to gain the skills and this experience and this knowledge through your work?
Yeah, I think it's a fairly new skill set, I would say. It's not a complex skill set because the tools is already available. So I think it's more of enabling the developers, to empower the developers, to give them the tools so they have the direct throughput and direct understanding of what electricity efficiency and so forth that their code is producing. I don't think it's really trained within the universities as of now, but I think in the next 2 to 3 years, I'm sure that this is something that will come up where even from the start, to choose a programming language that's more energy efficient as opposed to a program that's not, for example.
Right. So there are a lot of things you need to consider to become a more sustainable IT company. So you have the hardware, you have the infrastructure, you have the software. So what do you think are the main challenges for a person running a company when it comes to implement sustainable IT concepts?
I think the challenge when I speak to my peers is that they struggle with where do I start? Because when you look at sustainable IT, it can feel a bit like an overwhelming topic and also a very wide topic. And I think the most important thing is that you start understanding where within the realm of your environment, within your company, where can you make the biggest impact, for example. If you are a company with 50,000 employees and say that you have roughly 30,000 white collars with an employee with a computer and an iPhone, for example, then you have a huge IT hardware asset that you should be managing in a different way, for example. But if you are a bank, for example, where you are more used to developing custom coding and so forth, then that might be the place to start. So I think establishing your initial carbon emission baseline or your greenhouse gas baseline is probably the most important step to get started, so that you can understand where does it make sense for you to start. Is it within your hardware? Is it within your data center? Is it within your procurement? Is it within your IT asset disposition process? So I think it's important to establish that baseline to get a good understanding of where you should start.
So maybe a good field for new consultants in this area, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Having a look to the future, to 2050, so how would your world look like if all the sustainability IT sustainable IT is implemented? So what would be the world in 2050 look like?
Well, I think we talked about it earlier in the podcast regarding energy we definitely need to fix the energy problem that we have collectively in the world. Energy security is probably one of the most important factors, not only obviously within the IT industry, but to fix that we have low carbon energy across the world is probably the key in 2050, I would say, so that we can start reducing our carbon intensity and our greenhouse gas emissions. But then also, I think with the digitalization and all of this new technology, not everything is positive in that sense. You can also use technology in very malicious ways. So I think also it's important to have these checks and balances in terms of the ethical components, in terms of how we manage the data, how we process data and so forth, and to automate it in a lot better sense than we do today. Because the GDPR went into effect a number of years back, but we're still doing a lot of these processes very, very manually. And we need to make sure that we build the ethical aspects into everything we do when it comes around the digitalization and technology development.
And what will we carry in 2050? How will the devices look like, and how do we treat them? How do we handle them, from your perspective?
that's a tough one, but I think if we talk about, I think we will have a much higher share of non-virgin material within our devices. I think hopefully by already 2030, we will see a major shift where our smartphones, our tablets, our computers, they are made out of more non-virgin material. So you'll see a more closed loop with material like plastics, like rare earth minerals, electronics, and so forth. They are fed back into the manufacturing process. But then I think we will also to do a lot more speech recognition in the way we interact with our tools going forward, as opposed to typing on a keyboard. And I think we will have a lot more voice commandos, and that will obviously change the dynamics of the devices that we have today. They will have a different shape and form.
Yeah, maybe they go away from this form factor style and more usability because it's more hidden. So maybe if you have the mobiles more in your pocket because you don't need to look at it, because everything will be told you through some other channels to your ears, to your eyes somehow, so that you don't have the need to present your device on the table, oh, that everybody sees, oh, you have the latest iPhone, you have the biggest Samsung or something like that, that just the features and the functionality is available somehow. So maybe bring it back from the status symbol just to a tool.
Yes. And equally important, obviously, that if you do that, then the processing power is even more going to be transferred into these mega data centers that we have today. So we need to ensure that we run these data centers in a more sustainable way, because we will be shifting a lot more from a client to a server perspective. So I think it's important to make sure that when you run your Netflix, your Disney, whatever, then these data centers also need to make sure that they are sustainable and run on low carbon emission.
Right. So it's, again, a holistic view on everything. So that means we go more in this circular way of handling things and working with things instead of this linear thing. So what do you think can the required infrastructure for upgrades, recycling, offset the losses of working places in the industry, which used to bring out new products in high frequencies?
Well, I think you know, just looking at the macro perspective now, with the shortages in the world on components, but also on raw materials, I think this creates a fantastic opportunity to become a lot more circular, because like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we generate 57 million tons of electronic waste today, but it's just put on a major pile that is the size of the Chinese wall, the weight of the Chinese wall. So we have a great opportunity to recycle this, to put these things, pick these things apart, and to put them back into the manufacturing process. So I think that there's a huge opportunity in a new industry emerging to not only break new materials, but to recycle existing material and put them back into circulation. So I think that's a huge opportunity going forward.
Yeah, and maybe investigating what is possible to recycle, and also design new products which are much more easy to recycle with less compounded materials which are impossible to separate after lifetime, right? So there
yes.
can be new developments bringing new ideas forward.
We have been experimenting with laptops and looking at recycling them, and what we found when we're working with some global partners is that they can actually recycle 98.5% of laptop today. That's the only thing that they can't fully recycle is actually mercury, because mercury is fluid in room temperature, so it makes it a bit hard to recycle it, and it's still cheaper to break new mercury. So that is the reason why most of these IT asset disposition companies that work with circularity, they can recycle roughly 98.5% of a laptop. So I think we're taking great steps in terms of circularity already.
Right.
But we need to increase the share, obviously.
Yes, and it holds a lot of potential also for the economics, and also for new working places, new jobs, and complete new ways of thinking in how our economics works.
Absolutely.
Right. Niklas, do you have a message for our audience?
Yes, absolutely. So looking at the realm of sustainable IT, and I think when I'm speaking to my peers and in the CIO community, CTO community, I mentioned that the biggest challenge is to get started with sustainable IT. And I have some concrete recommendations for you to get started. And that is really to first create your CO2 emission baseline. Look at your scope 1, scope 2, scope 3 emissions. Understand what's your gap. Understand what you can measure today. Once you have that in place, it's important to understand where can you make the biggest difference. Is it within how you manage your data centers, or how you manage your cloud providers, or how you manage your IT hardware? Or is it that you need to work more with sustainable IT procurement, for example? So it's important to first create a baseline, and then that will tell you the key use cases that you should execute on. And once you have that, you can start planning out your next steps and your journey to a sustainable IT enterprise.
What can we do as employees or at home to become more sustainable with our IT?
I think the energy, obviously. I think to be mindful that at least where I live here in Sweden, I can pay a few more cents to get green energy provided. I think the conversation and the cost is a bit different in the rest of Europe, but that's one way to lower your energy frequency or your carbon frequency. The second thing is obviously to use your products longer. Don't fall for the latest marketing trick to replace the latest smartphone or your computer or your tablet and so forth. Try to use your hardware for much, much longer.
Thank you very much, Niklas. I take your message as my closing words as well. It was great to have you as guest today in the show.
Thank you very much, Marcus. It was great to be on the show and to have a great conversation about sustainability and more specifically regarding sustainable IT. And don't hesitate to reach out on LinkedIn to continue the conversation.
A big thanks to all the listeners. My guest today was Niklas Sundberg, author of the book Sustainable IT, Playbook for Technology Leaders. My name is Marcus Nettelbeck. Stay healthy and curious.